Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to On Point. I'm Don Allen, and Studio A and over in Studio B is the great, the legend, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing this afternoon?
Fine, Mr. Allen. Just happy to be here in our beloved Shangri-La at the headwaters of the Mississippi River, not to be confused with the state of Mississippi, though we right up there with them as it pertains to race relations. Don, let me say this right at the top of the program. Happy to be here talking to our vast listening audience, both locally, domestically, and internationally. But first of all, our condolences from those of us here at our corporate studios to the victims of the terrible tornado in Oklahoma, particular Moore, Oklahoma, and the deaths of at least 24 individuals and particularly 7 children who died in an elementary school there in Moore, Oklahoma. Our condolences, if you will, to those citizens in what has become known as Tornado Alley. And also our condolences to 2 young children, elementary school students at a public school in St. Louis Park, who lost their lives on the bluffs overlooking the Mississippi River in St. Paul. 2 lives snuffed out, buried alive, if you will, as ground gave away. Erosion of the soil. To their families, if you will, and loved ones, the condolences from those of us here on this program.
Yes. We send our best wishes out to their families, like you said, and it's unfortunate, and those things happen, and it's just unfortunate. Well, Mr. Edwards, you know, we've had a lot going on in the last couple of weeks that, you know, we've had to extend the show out to 90 minutes instead of our usual hour. And this week is no different than the week before. But I think that we should start with on the front page of the Star Tribune, the city awards $3 million to the family of David Cornelius Smith.
And yes, Randy first, writing that story. And again, for our listening audience, locally, domestically, and internationally, a $3 million award was confirmed, voted on, and confirmed by the city of Minneapolis, $1.1 million to be paid to the family, $1.975 million to be paid to the attorneys who, you know, my thing is always think the victim, the one who's deceased, gone, beaten to death, tasered to death, and et cetera, should get the majority of the money, but that's not the way the system works. But anyways, the fact of the matter is I'm happy for their family. The young man, David Cornelius Smith, his brother, Larry Smith, an attorney in Chicago, Illinois, who really kept everything focused over the last couple of years. His brother is to be commended for the way that he made sure that the Bennett Law Firm, who, you know, as we said, made $1.975 million, almost $2 million in attorney's fees. But an interesting story. Mr. Allen, I think, has a specific email that was sent to us back in 2010, in which the head of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, which had statutory authority to have conducted a civil rights investigation as it pertains to the violation of Mr. Smith's civil rights under color of law, you know, it wasn't like somebody just made it up. Mr. Allen, why don't you kind of go in, and then I'll pick it up later on. But Ms. Velma Quarterville, the director of the Civil Rights, sent us an email and called Mr. Allen and myself liars
for
the issues that we had raised. Go ahead, Mr. Allen.
Well, let's give this some history. You know, Mr. Edwards, when this happened in the downtown YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, on the 6th floor where Mr. David Cornelius Smith was tased to death, by Minneapolis police, and I do have that video up in line online, the video from the actual taser, from the police taser, and it shows the brutal knee behind the neck, and they continued, and they tased him, and he fell backwards just like a board. it's pretty shocking to watch that video. But as you know, Mr. Edwards, in collaborations with the National Research Institute, yourself, myself, we went down to the YMCA to try to get a statement or some information from the director of that particular YMCA, and who actually ran in her office and decided that she was not going to talk to us at all. And so, right. I mean, that was okay. But then again, we approached the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, directed by Velma Corbell, and asked her that this is something that should automatically trigger an investigation under police brutality and violation of civil rights. Obviously, he's dead by taser, a member of the YMCA, too. We need to note that. David Cornelius Smith was a member of the YMCA downtown. And this is the email that the director of the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights sent back. As a member of the media, one who purports to be familiar with this department's process, you know that I cannot confirm or deny whether a case has been filed. Also, if you persist with disseminating information at a minimum, please verify your facts. She says, I am not or never been a board member of the downtown YMCA, period. Now, Mr. Edwards, I have to go back because at the time, Ms. Velma Corbell was listed as a board member of the YMCA. I actually took a screenshot and posted that at the time with the story. And so it was my sense that she was in protection mode for her fiduciary responsibilities or guardianship of the YMCA, and that's one reason why they did not open a civil rights investigation at all whatsoever. And so with that said, Velma has, or Ms. Corbell, whatever you like to call her, she has not done the citizens of Minneapolis any justice. Matter of fact, Mr. Edwards, she's cost them a lot of money, wouldn't you think?
My estimation, reviewing this case, and particularly the article in the Star Tribune, this was the same Star Tribune, by the way, that Mr. Allen and myself also approached to ask them to join us as media persons in investigating the tragic death of Mr. Smith, David Cornelius Smith. They saw no probative value with regards to doing that. Mr. Allen raises a very interesting legal point, and that is the role of Ms. Corbell as a fiduciary agent by virtue of being on the board. She is the one that actually lied about the fact that she was a board member. And I have to tell you that in the days and weeks immediately following the tragic death of Mr. Smith, her department was in full cover-up mode on behalf of the Y and the city and the police department. In fact, the then head of her police civilian review authority was directly involved in consultation with the police to disseminate information attacking the authenticity and the validity of the statements that we were making on this program. In fact, there were at least two consecutive programs where we talked about the circumstances surrounding the death of Mr. Smith. We brought it up again maybe in 5 or 6 weeks from that particular time later on in 2010. It was the job of at least two of her deputies, both of them attorneys, if you will, although they couldn't practice law anywhere, Mr. Brown and Mr. Samuel Reed, to meet and consort with members of our so-called black leadership, particularly the Ministerial Alliance group, which have come into play again in the death, and we'll get to that later on in today's program, the tragic, savage death of T.T. Franklin. But, you know, not unbeknownst to us, by the way, but Mr. Allen and myself indicate that, we were aware that a campaign of slander was being driven by Ms. Corbell and her two deputies, and that, as I said before, they were working very closely with the police department to suppress any public discussion of the tragic circumstances. You have to remember that was the second young African-American that had been tasered to death by the police. There was another young man whose last name was Smith, who had been tasered to death in the middle of the street earlier that winter in North Minneapolis, if you will. Unfortunately, an attorney who had that case, a man by the same last name, by the way, by the Smiths here, bungled that case to the extent that it was thrown out, which was a travesty, if you will. But to your question, Miss Corvell cost the city at least $2 million of that $3 million settlement by virtue of her continued guarantees to the mayor that there would be no public discussion and that, you know, if there was anything that needed to be done, cover-up was in place. And so her email to us, and could you give the time and date of that email, by the way, for all the naysayers and et cetera out there? Do you have that, Vera's looking at you over there?
Yeah, I just copied and pasted the email. But this was on September 22nd, 2010.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. By the way, as it pertains to the authority and the obligation to reveal, Ms. Corvell was absolutely incorrect. I helped write the civil rights legislation for this city as a younger African-American, a member of the community, and became a member of its first commission, if you will, way back in the 60s. And, in fact, we reflected that, Mr. Allen, on our program way back in the summer of 2010 in the fall. She was absolutely incorrect and intentionally incorrect, if you will. That was a ruse, if you will. That was an attempt to cover the role of the Civil Rights Department in the complicity surrounding the circumstances of the murder of David Cornelius Smith. Yeah, that's the role that she played.
And that's very interesting that you bring that up, Mr. Edwards, because on Saturday, November 13th, 2010, we talked about Quincy Smith, Dominique Felder, David Cornelius Smith, and 15-year-old Courtney Williams. If our listeners remembered, the Star Tribune, who tried to sanitize that, did not really tell the whole story about a young man who had a BB gun, and he was shot in the back of the head twice, actually, point blank. And that murder. So all these people were either killed by shotgun or taser by Minneapolis police.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I find very interesting. A pellet gun he had resembling a .45 handgun. This is Mr. Courtney Williams. I'm just kind of jumping around just to fill listeners
in.
Yes,
yes, go right ahead, though. Mm-hmm.
And bring them up to speed to let you know that we've been talking about this since it happened. And so, you know, he had a pellet gun and was found 15 feet away from his body. That's what police said. The family's attorney at the time, Jill Clark, said a gun was found on the other side of a 6-foot fence where Courtney was killed. And this was another weapon. So it was not the BB gun. So we have some obvious tomfoolery going on there with a pellet gun turns into a regular weapon. And
absolutely.
So,
by the way, the police officer who shot and killed Courtney Williams himself was later fired and was in prison about a year and a half ago. Because of an incident and the firing of weapons and et cetera, and then lying in a situation at a home in South Minneapolis, in which, interestingly enough, when police came into the home after shots had been fired, there were underage young women there, and there was a significant amount of cocaine and other drugs on the table and et cetera. That officer was allowed to be exonerated, if you will. And the officers who had fired their weapons as a part of shooting up the neighborhood ultimately were terminated. Actually, we're supposed to get a little bit of time, 6 months, if you will. It really never happened. But that officer who shot and killed Courtney Williams himself was ultimately fired from the department, but not for that particular violation. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So, yeah, and there's a couple other, you know, instances going in here. But like I'm saying, I put that link up, too, on our Blog Talk Radio page. If people want to look at the history of the gentleman that I just mentioned and the police involvement, and in this case where our Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights stands still and does not actually do anything. And Mr. Edwards, you know, as someone who you know, authored some of the civil rights legislation here in Minneapolis, that at some point a Civil Rights Department should activate or deploy in cases such as these where there are questions and probable cause.
Don, let me just say, we the terminology that we initiated is called self-initiation. We gave that latitude, and when I say we, I'm talking terms, we began to work. I began to become a part of this as a very young African-American Negro slash. We began to write civil rights legislation in this town as early as 1960, before the insurgency, before the uprisings of 1965, 66, 67, and 68, where there was disturbances, rioting, et cetera, in the streets of our city because of police community relations. Yet in over 50 years, nothing's improved. In fact, more blacks are being killed now by the police than ever before. This is a very dangerous town that we live in.
Well, here, since you said that self-initiation, now, Mr. Everett, we've been watching, and this is not really all, it's part of what we're talking about here, but I need to ask you this question just to be clear in my mind and also maybe for our listeners. We understand that education is a civil right, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Then for the last 10 years, with the failing grades of poor people in Minneapolis, shouldn't the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights seek to address the Minneapolis public schools? And
under the current ordinance, Mr. Allen, written by some of us, in which I participated in many, many years ago, the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department and the commission, nobody even talks about the commission anymore because the Civil Rights Commission, which basically has no African Americans on it, does not do anything, just waste its time. But the commission and the department have the right to call public hearings.
Okay.
The last time that we really had a public hearing was when the current director of the department, deputy director, Kip Brown, was given a contract by Jane Khalifa to do a report on disparity in the workplace.
Oh, geez.
And we had a public hearing at the Urban League in North Minneapolis. That was 8 years ago.
Okay.
The commission has really not had a public hearing in 11 years on anything.
Wow.
To your specific question, the ordinance did and still does give the commission and the department the authority to self-initiate public hearings, take testimony, make reports, and et cetera, on issues pertaining to housing, education, employment, police community relations, and et cetera. Now, this is a commission that they haven't had a public hearing and a public discussion in over 11 years.
Yes, okay. So with that said, you know, at this point, you know, with Ms. Corbell and her lack of activities, I think that we should actually call for her resignation. I know on yesterday, Mr. Edwards, I did send a message via social media to Mr. Gary Schiff and also Ms. Councilperson Bethy Hodges to kind of look at this and resign three individuals, two individuals, including Bella Corbell. Well, this would be their head of their investigation unit and the CRA director.
How on point you are on that, Mr. Allen, because on her watch, if you will, $9 million of the money of the taxpayers of this city, see, that money doesn't come out of the police department or the chief or the mayor. $9 million, according to the information posted by the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Johannesburg Times. That's my nickname for them. I'm legendary with respect to that. Just since 2010, when this woman became the director of civil rights, coming over after being for 7 years under Republican governor, the commissioner of the Department of State Human Rights, $9 million has been paid out in lawsuits for policemen's conduct ranging from beating people to killing people. And this woman has not mumbled a word, and at the time that it was still in existence, the Civilian Review Authority was under her direct supervision. Since late or mid-2012, they've reorganized it and taken her favorite blocking buddy, Kip Brown, and he is now the head of something called the Office of Police Community Responsibility. $9 million. $9 million. Now, by the way, since, and this is the Star Tribune again, and our audience needs to know this, and by the way, if you need to get a phone number, phone lines are open. Since just 2006, this city has paid out $17 million in just individual lawsuits, including $4 million to an Asian police officer that the police shot and incapacitated and wounded, and I mean some serious injuries, if you will, to Dewey Noll.
Yeah, died
later as an outgrowth of depression,
yeah,
and et cetera, committed suicide.
And then the $2.19 million in 2011 to the family of Dominique Felder, shot to death in 2006.
On 37th and Bloomington by two police officers. Let me just say on this, as we go over each of this, I'm going to give the deep background. If it had not been for the presence of two high-ranking Minneapolis police officers, one black, one white, one now the sheriff of this county, Sheriff Richard Stanek, who at that time was a captain and was the head of CID, the Criminal Investigation Division, and then Lieutenant, now Commander, Manuel Arredondo. If it had not been for their presence at the scene, a gun would have been planted, and the attorneys and the heirs of Dominique Felder would not have been successful in that lawsuit. That is an absolute fact, and I was there and know each and everything that happened. They were going to try to plant a gun after he had been brutally shot in the middle of the street. He was a small fellow and slight, probably about 130 pounds. These two cops actually picked him up, hoisted him up, and shot him from each side. Okay? Just brutally murdered him. The hero in that situation, by the way, and the Star Tribune, never, Johannesburg Times, never gave the proper credit, were the two police officers I've just previously named, then Captain Richard Stanek and then Lieutenant Mario Arredondo. But it was a white citizen who lived in a house who saw everything from his window, who came forward before the grand jury and testified at trial. Okay?
Mm.
In the case of Dominique Felder, in the murder of Dominique Felder. Continue on, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, and then we also have to talk about this, too. This next issue I'm going to bring up, and this goes back to Mr. David Cornelius Smith. Because, Mr. Edwards, as we well know and we're the first to report it, based off tips from people from Hennepin County that tune into the show, their EMTs were called to the sixth floor of the YMCA in downtown Minneapolis. He was reported first dead on the scene. Less than 2 hours later, reports from the local media said that Smith was in critical condition on life support. And our question back in 2010 was, how was he resurrected? And was this a part of the body part harvesting that had been going on when, you know, a lot of these black youth and black men have been shot or tased to death by the Minneapolis police? And that story on the start was in the Star Tribune that states he was in critical condition on life support. And then, you know,
that was all a facade. That was a fake to do just what we reported back in 2010. Oops. And all that can be recaptured. You don't have to leave us. Go back on demand and you can call up those radio programs. Mr. Smith was thought to be worth maybe about $500,000 in regards to harvesting his vital organs. And that's what that was really all about. I think that was one of the reasons that Susan Siegel, the Minneapolis city attorney who made final presentation to the Minneapolis City Council yesterday to pay $3.075 million, said we need to get this done because apparently Bennett, the law firm, they won't confirm it, I guess, now, but I think Larry Smith, Cornelius Smith's brother, will confirm it. Star Tribune pretended like they weren't able to contact him yesterday. That wasn't true. But what was going to happen, it was going to also come out, that whole scenario that we first reported exclusively here. By the way, Velma Corvell said that we were liars about that also.
Yes, she did.
Clearly,
she did.
The record now shows that we were very much on point as communicators and broadcasters.
And
they harvested his body parts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did. Yes, they did. I have a message for the Star and Tribune, Johannesburg Times, and I just need to share that with them right now, okay? You dirty bastards, for posting that story about David Cornelius Smith and opening up the comment session for the racist redneck Peckerwoods to comment on. And I want to say something because I got very heated this morning, Mr. Edwards, reading these comments.
Uh-huh.
David Cornelius Smith, as confirmed by HCAMC, did not have any drugs or alcohol in his system.
Absolutely not, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay? And for some of them comments to be up there talking about, you know, all these, you know, thugs and gangbang and this, the guy had a membership to the YMCA. The little white girl sitting at the receptionist desk got nervous because he was upset about something, obviously throwing basketballs in the gym, and called the police. The police don't have any sensitivity training here under Dolan or under anybody else, and so they tased the guy to death. Okay?
Yeah.
Get the story real. This is not a special interest thing. This is not something that, you know, all these black people. But it's a shame, a dirty, stinking shame. You know, the Star Tribune, they won't turn on the comments for stuff when they talk about, you know, some other issues. But for something like this, they want, oh, it's a waste of money. You know, those guys never, they don't know what to do with the money. They're like the Native Americans. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. In fact, what has happened here in the Twin Cities is that all of our white-controlled media, which, of course, is the television stations and the newspaper, they have calculated in allowing these comments on their websites, which are extremely vicious. And we'll be touching on that a little bit later in this program again for our listening audience, because we will be doing an update on T.T. Franklin, who, by the way, whose head was actually blown apart. But we'll get to that in probably about 30 minutes or whatever. That is intentional. That is that is a commitment by the Minneapolis Star Tribune to intensify racial animus and racial tension in the city. That has to be calculated, because the comments that are made are comments that are without foundation. They're without clarity. They're without any kind of legal structure, if you will. But their reporters are, quote-unquote, committed to that same kind of yellow journalism. So one should not be surprised, if you will. I have been a watcher of this yellow journalism at this paper since, you know, the 1950s. And it's too bad that it's necessary to become that emotional. But I have to say to you, my friend, my conservative friend, that this is calculated. This is designed by the Minneapolis Star Tribune to cover its behind when these kinds of situations backfire. They did the same thing to Dewey Noe, okay? The Asian officer who was severely wounded and who, as an outgrowth of his wounds and other kinds of situations, became depressed to the extent that he committed suicide. After winning a $4 million judgment against his employer, but he was so demoralized and so depressed. And that was somewhat calculated, because that was something else that's been talked about since his death a little over a year ago, that they could see that there were problems of depression, particularly when there was no prosecution of the officers that shot him that night, his own fellow officers who were allowed to, quote-unquote, go into contract military services and take a leave of absence from the police department. Oops.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Yeah. I'd like to give that number out. If you got a couple more things, I'd like to give that number out.
You're breaking up a little bit, Don. I notice our,
okay,
our link doesn't sound to be too good. Yeah. Go ahead. What else you
say? I'd like to give my number out to get into the show today.
Don, you're breaking up. You're breaking up. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Our number is 347-426-3904. And our phone lines will be open in a couple minutes here, but I'll put that so folks can write it down. Again, that number is 347-426-3904.
Don, you got to make an equipment check there, man. You're losing it. That phone number didn't even come across real clear.
Okay. How is this? Is this a little bit better? I have engineered the board a little bit.
No, we're still getting that same bleep in there. I don't know, maybe some satellite interference intentionally, but it's not coming across. You've got some technical problem there in Studio A.
Okay, I will work on that, but I can hear you clear, so you go ahead while I twiddle with this a minute.
Okay, a couple other issues on this situation with David Cornelius Smith. The Minneapolis Star Tribune's front page story in this morning's edition attempts to portray a balance of fairness as things were reported. One of the things that the writer, Mr. First, tended to forget, and yet he wrote this same story over a year and a quarter ago, and that was that one of the things that really began to hurt the city's case was when, under discovery, the Bennett law firm discovered that the officer who is identified as having recorded the actual death of Mr. Smith there on the floor at the YMCA, actually that later on and into the summer of the following year actually showed that at parties and barbecues and talked in terms of the death of an animal, if you will. They confiscated his phone, and they confiscated the video from the taser, video that he was allegedly showing on the camera that was on his shoulder. And that information, the city attorney began to feel after it was brought forward on discovery, would seriously impact the city's case and position. And I know that is consistent with the thinking of the city council, because they were coming off some significant lawsuits that they had lost. So people need to be aware of that as they read Randy First's column on the front page of this morning's Minneapolis Star Tribune. Just a vicious situation. By the way, Mr. Allen, now hopefully we're getting those technical problems prepared. Yes. We have a couple of blacks that are missing after being apparently jumping into the river in the presence of police, by the way. We have one Pacific young man, need to talk about that at this point, a Mr. Jackson, who went from point A to point B to point C, where he has obviously, well, something has certainly happened to him. He has not been seen in over a week. He did not report to his job. He has an excellent job with a suburban school district. He had texted his sister that he was being stopped for investigation of DWI. The police were towing his car, which they did. They were going to take him to jail, which no one knows if they did or not. He leaves the area of Highway 252 and 69th Street in 69th Brooklyn Street Park. Some way or another makes it over 10 miles, I guess, by either walking or hitchhiking. And about 5:30 on last Saturday morning, allegedly jumped into the Mississippi River, becoming like the fourth person to jump into the Mississippi in about a two-day period. But he's the second African-American to die, to come under, because of questionable circumstances, to become an individual who clearly has expired, if you will. Just a year ago, a young African-American had the same thing happen in that same area, Highway 252. In fact, we call it the killing field, because there's been a number of African Americans that have disappeared up in there. That's right there on the border of Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, along the Mississippi River. That Mississippi River, I tell you, Don, I got to tell this story as we talk in terms of the relationship of the Minneapolis Police Department with the community. In 1995, a grand jury investigation was going on against a Minneapolis police officer for allegedly writing letters, and this is a female officer, to her colleagues, indicating threats and et cetera. And they were attempting to place the blame on her. And what happened, there was a black female, who had firsthand knowledge of the conspiracy and the plan to destroy the Black Police Officers Association. It took another 15 years to do that. And I got to tell you, Don, I was present with her when she talked in terms of a white police officer who later killed another young African-American in North Minneapolis around 1999-2000. But she told the officer about how it had been described to her by this Caucasian officer, how they had killed in 1995 two Native Americans under the old Plymouth Avenue Bridge. okay, and threw them into the Mississippi River. I mean, she gave this information to an FBI agent who later was forced into retirement. So if anybody, because I really don't want anybody to waste my time trying to challenge, so we'll just cut to some of the chase. But that went to a grand jury. And what happened, the grand jury refused to indict the black police officer, and a lot had to do with the information that came forward during that month-long grand jury investigation about the culture of violence and hatred in the Minneapolis Police Department against African Americans, including their own fellow black officers. So when we, Mr. Allen and I, are talking on this program, and of course for 5 years I sat as a federal monitor for the Department of Justice involving this department, but long before that as chairman of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission and back in the 70s as chairman of its police oversight committee when we had subpoena powers, I know and understand the history of hatred and animosity towards African Americans, including their own fellow officers, Mr. L. So I just want to, you know, make sure we continue to clear the record, because there'll be other tidbits that we'll be doing over the remainder of this program. Okay?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, since we're there, speaking of getting thrown off bridges, and I'd like to maybe open a phone line up for one particular caller who is going to be a caller here, but there are some mysterious circumstances, Mr. Edwards, regarding this young man, Jerome Jordan, Gordon Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I received some information a few days ago and ended up posting a story that within 24 hours was read 482 times on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's some conflicting information as it pertains to Jerome Gordon Jackson. Now, we know that a body, Mr. Edwards, was pulled out of Mississippi by the Ford Dam, but we have not gotten any confirmation from the mainstream media, even our inquiries on the identity of this individual. But
when you were talking to Mr. Walsh, the political legal writer for the Star Tribune, who was telling you that they were aware of Mr. Jackson, he wasn't talking about Mr. Jackson. He was talking about two young Caucasians from Wisconsin, one a female, one a male, who jumped off of the Stone Ark Bridge sometime last week. They think they may have recovered the body of the young man. I don't believe they recovered the body of the young lady. That's a tragedy within itself. But, you know, they're pulling so many bodies out of the river. I mean, you know, it's clear that we had a winter of discontent and murder in these Twin Cities, if you will. But because I had also talked to them, Don talked to them actually a couple of days before you talked to them, had advised them on some things to do. I'm not sure that they did it or they followed up like they were supposed to. But one of the things that initially came out from a sheriff's deputy for the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, which is the county that we reside in, that initially they had placed a Minneapolis police officer at the bridge at the time that Mr. Jackson went over. As the situation began to compound itself, that scenario changed and the police officer became some citizen by the name of Jerome or something like that. You know,
yeah,
like
Damon.
Almost the
yes.
same name. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, when members of the family asked for the incident report of the incident on the bridge, as well as the incident report of the stop at Highway 252 and 69th Street, it could not be produced, which is a serious mm-hmm. violation of everybody's departmental policy, be it Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, State Highway Patrol, Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, and Minneapolis Police Department. But there was apparently a police officer on that bridge. But that story has now changed. So, hey, you know, maybe a member of the family may hear and may want to call in. You said you think you have a caller, by the way? We want to get them in.
So, well, they're not yet, but hopefully they'll get here shortly.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
The thing is
okay.
that, Mr. you know, we are going to have to take a look at the camera. The city of Minneapolis and the police department who, if I'm not mistaken, has cameras across the bridge.
Don, you will not be able to gain access to that because that is now a crime scene, and
mm-hmm.
Only attorneys would be allowed to access that, and it would have to be attorneys who have direct involvement with the case. I meant to tell you that the other day. you won't be getting any access to those cameras on that bridge. I can tell you that no time soon. By the way, the family also, for our listening audience, went to last Monday, approached the FBI. FBI told them they weren't interested. There wasn't enough evidence that anything had happened to the guy. That's how they referred to him, as the guy.
Oh, wow.
As opposed to your loved one, or et cetera. But we have that kind of situation here because basically the U.S. Attorney's Office has basically changed hands with the current U.S. Attorney, Todd Jones, trying to become the head, the new head of the ATF, and all of his concentration is going on that appointment by Obama. The office is now being basically run and managed by interests that really don't care about protecting black folks' rights. So be advised.
That's not a good thing. Mr. Evans, I think we have a caller here. Stand by.
Uh-huh.
A caller, you're live on the air. Hello. Okay, we're going to put you back in the queue.
Okay, let me also do this update on T.T. Franklin. The funeral was this past Thursday. It was his body prior to the funeral was not a very pretty sight, if you will. We have written a number of articles. We have also posted on our own website, the Minneapolis Story Through My Eyes, additional information and questions, as well as our column. This week we will have another story in depth examining his killing, the homicide of Mr. Franklin in that basement, and the fact that he was shot many multiple times, and he was shot at least six times in the head, just basically blowing his head apart. I have to say this, Mr. Allen, there in that basement on the 10th day of May in the year of our Lord, 2013, there was a lot of anger and mean-spiritedness, if you will, and hatred in that basement as they beat, brutalized, and ultimately killed Mr. Franklin. And it's really unfortunate that leaders had misadvised the family in the early hours of this tragedy, if you will. And it really culminated when a local Southside minister, who we said, you know, we'll tell the names if anybody's bold enough to call us and ask us, who went to the chief's office, actually was trying to deliver information to the chief that had been obtained from the father. I don't know if the father knew it or not, to indicate to the chief that that minister was going to play their normal role of keeping the police department informed of what was going on, if you will. But he was so drunk when he got there, the actual notes that he had dropped out of his hand, and what happened, a deputy chief happened to pick him up, and he saw a specific name on the notes of a conversation between the father and this particular individual. And so this became a series of documents that were, or in this case, notes, that were a prime interest to the police as it pertains to the continued cover-up in the death of T.T. Franklin, a young African-American brutally killed here by the police on May 10th at approximately 3:30, 3:35 at 2717 Bryant Avenue South. So it continues, Mr. Allen. We've had some, you know, so that folks who pretend like they can't remember, we've had some very celebrated cases here of African-Americans who have been brutally, not even mysteriously, brutally killed. Let me just say this for our listening audience. I well can remember one of the most significant and creating some of the most significant amount of tensions was the death of Sel Saran Scott, who was stopped on 7th Street in Oak Lake, where the MTC bus is. Actually, it was a personal issue involving one of the police officers and the fact that Sel Saran Scott had talked to a young lady at a club called Moby Dick's. And bottom line, though, was that a shotgun was put to the back of his head, to his ear, behind his ear, fired, blew the whole top of his skull off. Went across the hood of the police car and landed on the other side. I mean, there was a cover up there, but the federal authorities did investigate it for 2 years before they finally made a determination, no probable cause. But what a lot of citizens don't know, except for the heirs, if you will, and relatives of Sal Saran Scott, is that 4 years later, the city of Minneapolis actually made a significant settlement with the family, big six figures, if you will. So this continues to be the history. We all know the history of Tysel Nelson, shot and killed by Officer Dan May, and then a gun was planted. They were so haphazard in doing that, they planted a gun that had been in the trunk of the police car, and they didn't realize that the barrel actually had dirt in it. I'm talking about hardened dirt. Mm. And you know, these are issues that some in our community still remember, still can reference, if you will, these young African-Americans. We had another one, young African-American on Glenwood, right there at Penn, was hogtied one night, was begging for some kind of relief from the pain, and an officer, police officer actually, because they also carry this foam pepper, if you will, pepper gas, and they actually shot it, put it in his mouth, and he suffocated. See, that's another way we knocked you out of the box. See, a lot of times folk didn't know in back in the early 90s and et cetera, that a lot of these youngsters that were having problems with breathing and et cetera is because they were using that foam pepper gas or pepper spray, and they would shoot it right in your mouth. You understand what I'm saying to you, Mr. Allen? You were in the military. You did gas training.
Oh, yeah.
They'd give you that gas mask.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes they wouldn't give it to you, send you in that chamber and see how you reacted.
I'll send you in the chamber and then pull the mask off when you're in there. And, Mr. Edwards, we have a caller.
Okay. Don, you're still breaking up, but I hope I can hear the caller. Let's get the caller in.
You're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hello, caller.
Are you Yes. Hi, Don and Ron. This is Queen Nucci calling in, and I just was wanting to, you know, be supportive. I had a sister named Roxanne who was talking about these very same issues about how we are being treated. And Mr. Edwards, if you can recall, I actually brought a young lady in to the NAACP years ago whose baby had been bitten by a rodent. And later her baby died.
Queen, I remember. And in fact, Roxanne, you're talking about, that's Miss O'Brien?
Yes,
right. Now, I know you're talking about. Yeah, she's been kicking dust today, Jack, I got to tell you.
Well,
go
that's
ahead,
what
on,
we
queen.
Need to do. That's what we need to do, and we need to be more conscious about what's going on in our community. And as a concern, that's why I'm calling and letting people know that we really need to be out here addressing these different issues. About what's going on with this police brutality and them just sweeping us under the rug as if we don't exist. We need to confront those very issues. And so I thank you for having this dialogue and platform and being on the show.
All right. Thank you, Queen. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right. Yes, and a longtime activist, by the way. Queen Nucci has been a longtime activist. Makes a lot of people nervous when she comes around because she basically always has had excellent information. Yes, I didn't realize that. That's Miss O'Brien, Roxanne O'Brien, who has been posting all the last couple of days, particularly today, has been a firestorm, raising the same questions as raised by Queen Nucci just seconds ago, Mr. Allen. But we're not going to have a dialogue, Don. Let's be very honest with each other. These folks are bag men and bag women. They've been paid off. In fact, given some of their own lifestyles, they can't afford to have a dialogue. You know what I mean? Cut off them and their drug trafficking and other kinds of activities that many of them are involved in. That's really why you don't hear us. You know, do you realize in the case of the Jackson young man, who many will maintain they don't know anything about, but particularly in the case of Mr. Franklin, you realize there's not been a mumbling word from the NAACP Urban League, the Ministerial Alliance, the Ministerial Alliance, the Leadership Alliance, none of those folks. But what they will do, as Velma Corvell and them did in the case of the murder in which the city of Minneapolis has had to pay almost $3.1 million, they will go out and tell people that the few advocates you have are, quote, unquote, not factual, not truthful, don't know what the hell they're talking about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's those kinds of leaders, by the way, that actually helped destroy, Don, the Black Police Officers Association here in 2007, mm-hmm. when the Black Police Officers Association actually reached out to the so-called Ministerial Alliance in it would have been a meeting at the Urban League in July of 2007. We'll tell it now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the ministers came in, and they was walking and talking, including a couple of them involved with drug activity. And they were entrusted with meeting with the mayor and the chief, particularly the chief, Tim Dolan, at that time, to indicate that they were in support of the Black police officers. And in late September of 2007 at the Southside Ermley, we had a meeting, and one of their representatives, a former politician, came in. And one of the things that he said was that the ministers had made a decision that they couldn't do anything for the Black police officers until the Black police officers did something for themselves. Well, on December 3rd, 2007, the Black police officers, five of them, filed suit in the federal court against their own department, putting their careers on the line. We went back to the ministerial group and to the leaders, if you will, and said, okay, they've come out and et cetera, et cetera. The brother said, ain't nothing we can do for them.
Wow.
And that was the beginning of the end of an effective Black Police Officers Association, even though five of those officers won a small amount, $725,000, but they left $1.3 million on the table. I never have understood why that happened. But the key was is that they received no support from community, just as the female officer that I talked about over a decade and a half earlier had received no support from the community when she was being persecuted and prosecuted for allegedly sending the hate mail.
Okay, Mr. Edwards, we have another call.
Oh, let's get the caller. Caller,
you're live on air. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, you're live on air.
Yeah, I'd like to know the name of that minister you're talking about.
Ian Bethel. Ian Bethel is the minister, sir. Good for you. Glad somebody finally called. Ian Bethel is the minister who went to the chief's office on Wednesday of last week, not this week, Wednesday of last week, inebriated, intoxicated, drunk, and to the extent that they actually forced him to take a cab. But what happened, he had some notes with him. And those notes contained a discussion he had with the father and identifying who the father's source was with respect to how the father, Walter, how his son had been brutally murdered. And actually, the good minister was carrying the information to the chief to make the chief aware of what this individual had, who had obviously penetrated the police department's investigation, was sharing with the father, encouraging the father to obtain an attorney and such things. That, by the way, Mr. Allen, let me just say, for the general public, the family of T.T. Franklin, the deceased young African-American, has retained a legal counsel. They got a lawyer. I'm not at liberty, caller, if you're still there, I'm not at liberty to reveal the name of the attorney. I'm sworn to confidentiality on that, but I can assure you that probably by the beginning of next week. Certainly, Mr. Allen would be in a position to talk about it on next week's program. But to the caller's question, yes, it was the Reverend Ian Bethel, who, by the way, preached the funeral of the deceased on Thursday at his church, New Beginnings, in South Minneapolis.
Wow.
And hollered, raised his hand and said, I swear that we will bring to justice the murderers of this young man. Yeah, that's the kind of hypocrites that these folks are.
And we have
but at least he was sober.
Okay, caller, you're live on the air.
Hello?
Yes, caller, I'm sorry, you're live on the air.
Yeah, go ahead, caller.
Oh, yeah, NAACP, what, have they spoken publicly?
The who?
The
NAACP's in transition. Their president, I think, stepped down. The National brought pressure on him because he was talking a little bit about, you know, too many things. But also, he's in a very delicate situation because, as we've said before, Booker Hodges, who was the president of the Minneapolis NAACP, is a sheriff's deputy in another county. And so that's a real tight situation, because that whole thing about, you know, the thin blue or, you know, brown line, because, you know, a lot of the sheriff's departments wear a lot of brown, is correct. But to your specific question, no. And I know I sense call that you're calling us from outside of the state. We no longer even come to expect the NAACP or the Urban League or the Ministerial Alliance to take up these kinds of issues. As our previous caller said, black folk in this town, in this city, or in this state, are out there on their own, buddy. Any other questions, sir?
I thought the city of Minneapolis was trying to diversify, especially the fire department. Do they have more blacks working, fire department?
The fire department has proportionally, at one point did have the best numbers of any fire department in the United States. And, of course, I'm well-versed on which I speak, because for over 20 years I was the federal monitor for the fire department. What happened was the Black Firefighters Association got sucker-punched. My prediction, as one who has been long involved with this since 1967, that in 10 years we'll have less than two or three blacks on the Minneapolis Fire Department. What happened was 325 white applicants were passed through to qualify for the list, only 14 African Americans. And the first 25 on the list to be selected for the next round of appointments to the fire department are all Caucasian. by the way, Don, that would have been something that Velma Corvell could have certainly dealt with and stepped into the fray, but chose not to. But to your question, caller, about the fire department, nothing's happening. And we're losing our numbers in the police department, per se, because there are a number of African-Americans who have retired. There's another group of African-Americans, all at command positions, who are probably going to retire over the next, you know, couple of years. And so we're losing our numbers in both our fire and police department of African Americans, but nobody cares. Nobody cares.
I think that's got a great platform. You should go and recruit people to become officers and firefighters.
We can't do that because that's a job that is already assigned. The Black Firefighters Association received money. Well, there is no Black Police Officers Association anymore, but, you know, that's the job of the city. They have a big budget. And that recruitment is done through, sir, here in this city, it's done through civil service.
Well, you can recruit
all you want, but unless you have legal standing, you're not going to be able to do anything when they violate the protocol and the test. As former Chief Alex Jackson, one of the finest chiefs we ever had, who decided to retire after what he saw was happening in this department under R.T. Ryback's leadership as mayor.
Yeah, well, maybe you can get a contract with Northside Achievement Zone there to do it.
With the who?
Northside Achievement Zone.
Oh, no, all they do is paint sidewalks. That's what that's their most current project as it pertains to the African-American communities, have the youngsters go out and paint this. I think they're painting the sidewalk in front of, what's that radio station, KOJM or whatever it is. But the Achievement Zone is not interested in real employment. I mean, let's be very candid. That's not happening. But right now, their key project is to do graffiti on the sidewalk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, caller, thanks for calling. Thank you, sir. We have another caller, Mr. Edwards.
Oh, let's get him in, man.
You're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
How you all brothers doing? This is Brother James.
Hey, Brother James.
How you doing, my brother? Good to hear your voice.
Hey, listen, I was trying to get on to the phone and give you guys a jingle, but it seems like somebody beat me to the punch. But, you know, we've discussed this thing before about the ministers here. Now, this is a blatant example of how the sinister ministers, when they be called upon by their handlers. Now, first of all, what is he doing going to the police station drunk with some crucial information to either snitch, tell, or sell, and then turn around and do a eulogy drunk? He should be excommunicated out of the church, like that one brother said 2 weeks ago or a week ago about one of our other ministers who's now got an Afrocentric side of him now. He wants to come together and bring the community together. Only thing we got here is a bunch of hypocrite, sinister ministers who are operating out of this so-called community hitman bag. There's no other hitman in this country no better than John Perkins, and that's the confession of an economic hitman. These cats get kibbles and bits, and they're out here doing the bidding for the white establishment, but they ain't really doing nothing as far as saving souls.
You know, that's absolutely right, man.
Finding their pockets.
You're absolutely right, bro. You're absolutely correct. That is a damn good point. And what the caller is talking about, what James is talking about, is that there's...
You all notice this, that every time you all hit something on Crucial Saturday, the spin doctor, a.k.a. Al McFarlane, a.k.a. Don King of the black community, he always get on his show and give them a spin cycle show.
We've been watching that for the last couple of years. You're absolutely correct. Well, I want him to get out there and do a spin on Jackson and Franklin and some of the information we put out. But, James, you're absolutely correct. That's what the spin doctor
do. You know why he ain't going to do that? You know why he's not going to do that? It's because that cute little 10-page newspaper he got will no longer be in circulation, and he'll be looking for a new home and a new mortgage.
Okay. Gotcha.
And that's just the way it is up here.
Yeah. That's what it is. Any specific questions of us, James, on what we've been talking about with regards to Franklin and Jackson? And because
you know,
we're always open to questions,
you
because
know,
we know how they talk about us behind our back.
You know, Mr. Edwards, I had a real good chance to meet before this brother passed away, and you and I know him very well. Brother Red Presley set me down one time in Target across from White Castle. He said, the reason why I don't go over there, Brother James, is because ain't nothing over there but a bunch of house niggas who done sold their souls out. He said, this is why I like to come over here to Target. He said, I can see you a well-read brother. He said, keep your eyes on the prize, watch these fools, and look out for them dumb ones over there with their beer overalls, smelling like dumpsters, pretending like their community spokesperson, but really they are illiterate community economic hitmen with no degree in anything but buzzardology. And on that
note,
I'm up.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, brother.
Whew. Interesting. By the way, let me just be editorial note. The legendary Raymond Presley, born, raised in St. Paul, actually historically became the first African-American allowed to play on the Gopher basketball team in 1949 after coming out of the military service. Great baseball player, great all-around athlete at Mechanic Arts. Later became the first African-American inspector of police in the history of the Minneapolis Police Department, also became the first African-American to head up the Internal Affairs Division, if you will. Just one a gem of a human being, if you will. And, you know, we were certainly sorry to hear about the firebombing of his daughter's home and that she shared with her husband. Certainly saddened by that because Raymond Presley represented all that was good and pure about this city.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
And Ms. Ertz, we have another caller.
Oh, let's get him in. Mm-hmm.
Hey, caller, you are live on the air. Go ahead, please.
All right. Thank you. It's Marianne Robinson.
Hey, and, Marianne, how are you?
This is completely... Okay, you guys is coming with too much. This is too deep, ain't it?
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
So how many Southern landowners we got up here in Minnesota now? When did they
Southern
come in?
Landowners?
Yeah. Because
you're
the whole
about
political,
right here in the city of Minneapolis,
right?
Buying
city
up all those vacant lots?
In the state of Minnesota.
Oh,
because
probably a lot.
The whole political, everything has changed.
Yeah.
Everything is so different from when I grew up here.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And that when they came up in here, they came right up into a trap in the 80s. They came right into a trap. And we were asking for black folks to come and help us out, not sell us out.
Right.
Oh, my God. And so I think what needs to happen is we need to start telling this story of what Minnesota, what Minneapolis was prior to this second migration.
Mm-hmm.
And what all migrated here, because we had Southern landowners following their renters. That changes the political landscape. And everybody, yeah, who wants to have a job had better buckle up to the system.
Okay.
I don't
all
have
right.
a job because I'm not willing to do that. And that's the that's the central problem, just with the young man that called in before.
Mm-hmm.
Our community leaders
yeah.
are not really our community leaders.
Yeah, they certainly aren't. All right, Mayor, appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Mayor.
You.
All right, thank you.
Hey, Mr.
By the
Harris,
way, on another note, Don, just want to give this report out also because there was criticism, people in the so-called educational category who protect the Manhattan Public School District. You know, I had been reporting to our community about what was happening at Green Central. And with the call by Marianne Robinson, my memory was immediately alerted. The principal, the former principal at Green, at the Green Magnet School, has been demoted. She has been moved. First of all, she's been moved out. She's been demoted from principal to vice principal, and has been sent to and will open next year at Lindale Elementary School in South Minneapolis. But there was a lot of criticism, particularly a lot of attacks on the outstanding educator, Professor Francine Chakolis, one of the great African-American educators. She took a lot of criticism in January, February, March, and April from a lot of snakes about that she was stirring up stuff, including she was attacked verbally and behind her back by Superintendent Bernadette Johnson for creating problems, but yet Superintendent Johnson went ahead and signed off on the demotion of Catalina Reyes as the principal at Green Central. So just wanted to bring that one out there too, Don. You're not going to find that in Insight or the Minneapolis Star Tribune, okay?
and you know, Mr. Edwards, Marianne, who I graduated from high school with here at Minneapolis Central in 79. I'm sorry, Marianne, I didn't mean to date you.
Look out now.
She brought up important things about jobs. You know, this tornado tomfoolery that they had Wednesday at the University of Minnesota UROC facility in North Minneapolis on Plymouth and Penn was a mess. And we were being told by our community spokespersons and leaders, Mr. Alfred Flowers, that he'll be fighting for jobs on the new Viking Stadium. And you know, Al and I talk every now and then, Mr. Edwards, but, you know, I need to see what the plan is on paper. And
well, there
like
is a plan. Isn't there a plan?
I don't know, but they seem to know something. But for me, I need to see, you know, what kind of observations, what have they put together to make sure that the community as a whole, because it's illegal to just get jobs for black people in North Minneapolis, period. Legal. Illegal. So
absolutely.
What is the plan to make sure there are jobs for everyone, poor people, underemployed, unemployed, or people that want to work? And Mr. Edwards, that little piece, because I don't really want to spend a whole lot of time of that dog and pony show they had at the tornado. And caller, I see you holding there, but just stay there. Give me a second here. Because I need to go into this piece here, Mr. Edwards, about... And it's going to take us back to 2008 to now with the Minnesota Department of Transportation.
DOT.
Mm-hmm. The DOT. Now, guy by the name of Lenny Chisholm, myself, you, Mr. Edwards, and a couple of us have actively engaged the MnDOT, the Office of Civil Rights, to talk about jobs, how they handle disadvantaged business enterprises, which are DBEs, their workforce, their collaboratives, and the things that they do to bring people into this government state kind of a bidding process, etc. Now, let me give you an example. In 2010 to 2011, October to May, then State Representative Bobby Joe Champion, and it was 59B, if I'm not mistaken, then, was the state rep, and he was the vice chairman of the Transportation Oversight Committee. Under Mr. Champion's watch, he let the Minnesota Department of Transportation or he watched the Minnesota Department of Transportation get federal funding for Minnesota's roads, highways, and bridges of $68 million. Then he reclined back in his recliner and watched only $715, let me repeat that, $715 go to one black contractor out of $68 million. I have this documentation, okay? I've posted it online everywhere. I have this documentation from MnDOT and from the Federal Highway Administration. Now, 6-7 months ago, Governor Mark Dayton, actually last year, at a press conference says, we're going to keep working with MnDOT. You know, call me in about 6 months, and we're going to see how MnDOT is doing.
Right.
Well, on May 13th, there was an audit of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And we have been saying this all along that, you know, MnDOT is not doing their due diligence. They are not these boutique engagement with the community and like putting a slave on show at these meetings. Like, look at this Negro here. We got them. They have a contract, you know, and they're doing something, you know, some little project, not too much money, but, you know, things like this. And, you know, we know a couple hundred thousand dollars went out to some black agencies in St. Paul to teach people building, which it turned out was just a hustle. So the results of the audit regarding the DBE, Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Pool and Participation, says, and I'm reading for the report, and the report is posted online on ourblacknews.com. It's right there. The pool of DBEs has not increased over the past 7 years. In addition, the participation rate of those DBEs in the pool remains low. Fact one. I'm just going to go through there. Based on a sample of contracts, we determined the contracts cleared on good faith efforts are over 50%. The audit determined an overuse of the good faith effort in 2010 and 2011, which means they were just, MnDOT was just taking phone calls and saying, okay, thank you, goodbye, and not enforcing anything. Conflict of interest. One task of the Office of Civil Rights is to monitor the companies in the DBE pool for those firms who no longer qualify as a DBE company. And they didn't. And so all this is in writing, and I'm just going through each of these pages here, kind of looking at some highlights. So this week, Mr. Edwards, Director of Civil Rights for the Minnesota Department of Transportation, MnDOT, Mary Prescott, was released. And I guess Mr. Alice Tittle is the interim director of Civil Rights.
And when you say released, Mr. Alvin, so we have absolute specificity, you mean she was fired, right?
Yeah, yeah, she's out of there.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yes. She's done. And I'd like to appreciate. I'd like to thank again Mr. Lenny Chisholm for providing me with this detailed and this is
report,
gonna piss you
narrative,
off.
Audit,
yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is gonna piss off Mary Ann too. In the year 2010, the percentage of dollars given to DBEs was 5.6%. In 2011. It was 7.6%. Yeah, it rose the percentage of dollars, but you're talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars, okay?
Uh-huh.
So that 5.6% could represent anything. And, of course, they didn't get into it in the
audit
as far as what that 5.6% represents. But the Office of Civil Rights has given presentations that indicated that MnDOT has met the following goals. The Office of the Civil Rights unable to substantiate participation rates for 2010 and 2011 and 2012. So they're telling people this, that they're doing all this great work, and then we're hearing things from places like Summit Academy, Dunwoody, MCTC, and all these trade schools that, you know, that they're working with MnDOT and MnDOT's doing this great work, when it's actually the case that from 2008 till now, MnDOT has failed its mission on as it pertains to CFR 49 Part 26. And I'll just paraphrase it here. It says, get it done. You know, all people should have an opportunity to work on Minnesota's roads, bridges, and highways. Of course, they
right.
need to be qualified. Okay? And
yep.
so they have not done that. So this is even in a case where Mark Dayton has has let the community down for real. And with that said, Mr. Edwards, we have another caller here real quick. Okay, you're live on the air.
Yeah, this is Brother James again.
Oh, hey, how you doing? Go ahead.
Go ahead, James.
You know, Mr. Edwards, I ran across an old piece of history that I'm pretty sure you're familiar with, and it would bring some validity to the fact that Mr. Allen is very correct when he calls these people the they're not spokespersons, they're spokespeople for the poor. I ran across a book. I ran across a book that was written in 1906. You might be familiar with it, Mr. Edwards. It's called The Civil Government of Minnesota by Hines, Noble, and Eldridge. In that book, it states very clearly that everything that's being done for the poor is being handed down by the county commissioner,
who was a powerful person back in those days. Yeah, go ahead, in that structure
and
of government.
And you know we had a county commissioner who had been sitting way past the 4 years allotted time that he's supposed to be there. That's why a lot of these politicians stick around a little longer than their allotted time is supposed to allow them. And on that note, I'm done. Peace out.
Okay, all right. That's interesting. That was a book that is reflected, would have been reflected if we'd have had a Black History Museum, but that $3 million went to Las Vegas. But anyways, excellent point by the caller. By the way, on back to Mr. Chisholm, I think it's important to remind, because we had him on the program a couple years ago, a couple times. You know, when Mr. Chisholm raised those questions in the so-called advisory committee, DOT advisory committee on set-aside programs and et cetera, he was ousted. And some of our African-Americans who were on that committee participated in ousting him. Because they maintained that he was stirring up unnecessary problems and keeping the natives restless. So Mr. Chisholm, though he certainly didn't need it, clearly has been vindicated by the political decision to fire the head of the Civil Rights Office for the Department of Transportation because of falsification of records, information, et cetera. But see, when Mr. Chisholm said that 2 years ago, the leaders that we're talking about, Don, began a series of calls and meetings and et cetera to slander him and to denounce him, okay?
Exactly. And also, Mr. Edwards, I need to add this in. Lenny, I went to a couple of those meetings with him, and, you know, you had people like Louis King, Kenya McKnight, a couple other folks came in the room and out of the room, and seems like, you know, those people turned their backs on this man speaking the truth, as you can see by this report that I hold in the studio right now, which, you know, based on CFR 49 Part 26, here it is, Mr. Edwards. I was CFR 49 Part 26. The goal for a specific contract would be higher or lower than percentage level of overall goal, depending on such factors as the type of work involved, the location of the work, the availability of DBEs, and the particular contract. However, the period covered by your overall goal, you must set contract goals so that they will cumulatively result in meeting any portion of your overall goal. You do not protect being able to meet those use of race-neutral means. So, I mean,
race-neutral, the key element, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so, I mean,
oh, by the way, that's the reason you haven't heard anything from the so-called Minority Contractors Association, which used to be the Black Contractors Association, until it was contaminated with all these folks that showed up out of nowhere. See, there it is again. For whatever reason, Governor Dayton, we have to give him, you know, you were a little critical of him from the right side there, Don, but we have to give him a little bit of credit, because what he has done, because people have been whispering in his ear for 3 years that, you know, there's some bad Negroes out there that are saying things that aren't true, as Velma Corvell did in that email, which you read at the top of the program, when she denounced us for raising questions about the death of Mr. Smith, of David Cornelius Smith. That is the same kind of policy and modus operandi of these organizations, the Ministerial Alliance, if you will, the Leadership Alliance, and et cetera. And the governor, to his credit, I must defend him from the left, Mr. Allen, when he is shown evidence that there has been compelling reasons to remove an individual for malfeasance, he's done that. And he probably could have went up a little bit higher at the Department of Transportation, but you got to remember, when he put a new person in there, he kind of indicated he expects some positive things to happen. And I have, again, I have to repeat that I have to give the governor of the state of Minnesota kudos for at least holding to his position. If I, quote unquote, as governor, am presented with the evidence, I will take an appropriate action, okay? And that's really what he's done. Hopefully he can get the state human rights commissioner will be able to do a little better job in trying to see that African Americans are allowed, I have to use the word allowed, to at least vie for jobs on the People's Stadium, by the way. And by the way, the group out of Kansas City is in constant communication and discussions with the Vikings, one of the two owners of the stadium, the other being the state. And they have over 100, as I said before, over the last couple months, they have 100 black journeymen / artisans ready to come to work here. And based on what that stadium is supposed to look like, you will have to come with significant skills from the get-go. There won't be no, and this BS about we going to make the unions don't hire anybody. Only people the unions hire are their own officers to lay back and make significant salaries. It is the, get some education. It is the general contractor, in this case Mortenson, and the actual owner, which in this case is the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Vikings. They're the ones that set the policy on who gets hired, okay? The unions don't hire nobody, all right? The unions are a pimp. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All they do is make sure you pay your dues, and half the time you pay your dues and you still don't get off the bench. That's mm-hmm. union terminology. You're still sitting there in the hall, quote unquote, in the union hall waiting to be called to go to a job. All right. And I think it's just so sad that folks keep talking about they're gonna get jobs and they're gonna make the unions. The unions can't do nothing. The unions can't make the general contractor do a damn thing. And the general contractor can't make the owner do a damn thing except fire him. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
I'm talking about firing the general contractor. Well, give mm-hmm. that number out one more time, Don, just in case. In the last, we're down to the last 4 minutes, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
If we got a caller, maybe out there, maybe someone
some
additional questions.
Sure. That number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904.
I want to repeat again, Mr. Allen, here from Studio B, that the family and loved ones and heirs, that's important legally, the heirs of T.T. Franklin have obtained legal counsel. They have obtained an attorney. Susan Siegel, city attorney, Minneapolis. City attorney, and by the way, you should hear what the county attorney is talking about over there to make sure that this doesn't go to a grand jury. Oops. Yeah, and I'm not so sure it makes much difference about trying to get the feds, though that's the only other place you can go, because the FBI has already cut their deals that they will make sure that they'll resist any investigation of the circumstances involving the violation of the civil rights of T.T. Franklin. But you see, for the purpose of prosecution, it would be the county attorney. Oh, by the way, let me say this to my good friends
okay.
at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Your article last Saturday, a week ago today, you guys violated, and you know you did, you violated criminal law, because the information that you had in that story was obtained illegally. Reminds me of the Daniel Ellsberg case of 50 years ago. You got to remember, Mr. Allen, that information was stolen from the files of the Minneapolis Police Department, and particularly its homicide unit and internal affairs. And I'm just kind of wondering how come Mr. Walsh didn't do a better job of advising his employer that to go with that story, that you were taking the chance that you may be compelled by a court to explain how you got the information and why you did not deal with the issues of an illegal act. See, that's the sources that they talk about, that information was stolen.
Wow.
Now, in the case of yours truly, my information came in a different method because we've been around a long, long time, and we know the traps. But the Star Tribune was involved in a felony in using that information.
Okay.
Okay. Just wanted to give a shout out to our friends at the Star Tribune.
Wow, and they need a shaking up. And we got like let me just double check.
Oh, John, let me quickly this because we had talked.
Okay.
Our sadness with respect to the demise of the beautiful Angela Davis at WCCO. You've been talking about that on your websites.
Yeah.
Angela Davis actually forced out. Pretty much so at WCCO.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to bring up, Mr. Edwards, because, you know, we have a campaign on Facebook. You can look it up, Boycott WCCO TV. And if you're listening, you know, search on Facebook and join that campaign. And, you know, they've reduced her to filling in for anchors when they're absent, Mr. Edwards.
For the pretty blonde, blue-eyed white girls. Yes.
Exactly. So I find that pretty shocking because, you know, right now, for the morning shows, Channel 9 is holding strong at number one. And, you know, they have Don Stevens over there.
Beautiful Don Stevens.
Yeah, and they have a pretty hip crew over there. And that sunglass crap that they're going to have people wearing at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning watching WCCO and Channel 11 and Channel 5 is not going to work. But, you know, this is the same thing that happened to Ashley Blake, I think her name is, or Carrie 11. Was she on the morning show? Yeah, in 1993 when, you know, I guess people was getting up tired of, or they were tired of seeing a dark-skinned, beautiful woman on TV, and they moved her off the station. So off Gear 11.
Well,
so.
It's the same thing they did to Harrison Faulkner, the same thing they did to the beloved and respected Robin Robinson, who for years held the chair there at Channel 9. And this is not the first time that Angela Davis has been disrespected, if you will, disrespected over there at Channel 5. I mean, just outrageous. See, when you take a person and demote them like that, and you make them kind of a cleanup and the utility player, given all the years that she has been highly valued, if you will. But they tell me that the general manager, they tell me that his favorite colored person is Reggie Chapman. They tell me he loved Reggie because Reggie reminds, well, I won't get into it, but he reminds him of some character out of one of them racist children's books. But this is a message that there's really no place at WCCO for an African-American that does not fit the white perception of what a Negro should be like. You know what I mean? Soft and things like that. Angela Davis was a news person. She was a journalist, and she was a damn good one. And it's really sad what has happened to her and the disrespect. But they told me when old boy came here from Florida that he, you know, let it be known that it was time to put paleness back into WCCO Channel 4.
Yeah.
You know, really, that's why our friend Don Shelby got out of there.
That station is a hot mess. I mean, I can't watch. I don't watch it anyway, Mr. Edwards, because I used to be a big fan of Wheel of Fortune, and that's probably the only thing I would watch. But as far as news, was not interested in news on there. So we have about 90 seconds left, and we're going to have to wrap it up. Any of the last thoughts here before we sign off?
No, but we'll have some additional background and et cetera on T.T. Franklin and the brutal murder of T.T. Franklin on May 10th, 2013, in the city of Minneapolis, in a basement at 2717 Bryant Avenue South, by police who were determined to make an example of a young African American. Take care, Doc.
Yep.